You're listening to Solva Spensa Musik at the Radio Rakla FM 99.3, your favorite feminist radio station. And today's guest is a musicologist, a researcher. He's actually an author of, I think it's two books. And he's also a performance artist and overall interesting person. So welcome to you, Marek Sisdorf.
Hello.
How do you say your name?
It's just Sisdorf.
Sisdorf.
Hello. Sisdorf. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's so great that that you were able to come here and share your thoughts. And it's going to be very exciting to see how this hour goes, because I don't really have an idea.
Okay.
I have a little bit of an idea.
Okay. We'll see about that.
We kind of have a plan, but let's see.
Yep.
So, maybe is it good to start talking a little bit about what you like to do in your life, like as an artist and as a researcher?
Yes, of course. So, I'm currently working at Oslo University here in Norway. So I moved here from the Netherlands, but I'm actually Polish. So for the last couple of years, I have been gallivanting around Europe a bit. And now I'm here. I'm actually finishing my PhD now. Hopefully it is going to happen soon. And I guess that's it in terms of my work in Oslo. It has been extremely, extremely difficult to go through that process of doing my PhD. Everything is in order, but I didn't envisage it to be that.
But what's so difficult? Like, what are the kind of obstacles that you could face, like doing the kind of research that you do?
Well, it's a never-ending, both story and work, actually. So you just go to work and you never leave it for the next 3 years. It's always there. It's not like a type of work that you go at, let's say, 9 o'clock and just leave your workplace at 5 o'clock and just shut the door and kind of change yourself into something else to spend a nice evening out, because your work is always in your head. I mean, you know, it obviously depends on a project, and mine is very philosophical. So it's, you know, I do not consider myself a writer, but I am definitely a writing person. And I love writing, and I think through writing, if I may say so. But it is a different type of writing. So previously, I have published 2 books, and I was always busy writing, actually. But it was, as I said, something different than academic writing.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, it's when you are creative, as a creative writer, you have the freedom.
Exactly. Which you do not have in the academia. Sorry to say that, but you feel constrained, in terms of your style, in terms of your creativity. Obviously, you are creating a story, which is actually recreating a story, not creating, right? Because first of all, my research is historical, so it's also, you know, it's archival research. So I cannot write about what I want. I need to find evidence for what I'm writing about for every single sentence.
It's tiring. There has to be some, like, you can't say truth, but you can say, like, there has to be some truthfulness, right?
That is correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to be analytical. And
that is correct. And it needs to be embedded somehow in reality. While when you're writing a novel, for instance, or whatever it is that you want to write, you can just rely on yourself. Here you need to rely on the canon, right? On other academics and other books, other thoughts, other concepts. So you're constantly, I would say, you're in a constant phase of conversation, okay, with somebody. While writing, at least for me, like writing a novel is very, a very self-centered activity where I can really rely on myself only, and I like it.
Yeah, maybe you'll have to go back to that as well.
So I would love to.
Yeah, when you finish your PhD.
Mm-hmm. I do hope so.
Yeah, we're going to hear later on an excerpt from one of your books.
Yes.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting. And also, by the way, maybe some of your listeners have heard another episode with Marek, which is this Beisa at Blå episode. Correct. Yeah, where we touched briefly upon there your research, but maybe just as a recap, you could just tell what it is about.
Sure, if we have time for that now. Yes. Yeah, I can absolutely.
We can talk a little bit about it and then we will introduce the first song.
Yep, so in broad strokes, my research is about... it's complex research, really. But just to begin with something, it's about the category of the human in a Western, let's say, cultural and economic empire, and how this category has been ideologically used, but also created and maintained by certain Western musical concepts and studies and practices. Mm-hmm. That's in broad strokes. But then I'm basing this research on a very particular example, which is a colonial relationship between the Netherlands and its previous colony of Suriname or Suriname in South America. So I'm looking at a whole span of the colonial relationship, and I am investigating the Western precepts and practices of music or organized sound, and how these concepts contributed to that colonial relationship. Yeah.
Do you have a title for your PhD?
Oh, not yet. I probably should, right?
It's going to be a short thing with a long subtitle.
You know that, right? You know, this is how they are usually created, and I think it is going to be like that. So I have got the short title, which is a very, I hope, catchy term for a very complex phenomenon, which is, I mean, the name is, or the first part of the title is music colonialism. Mm-hmm. So I think that it says at least something about what the research is.
Ah, it's kind of a buzzword worthy word. That was very
that
hard
is
to
correct.
Say.
Do you like it?
I like it. Okay, yeah, cool. I like it. I mean, it's a positive thing. Yeah. I mean, because it has the kind of like... it's like, bam, I'm here kind of attitude, this word.
And this is what I'm going to talk about, or this is what I'm going to investigate. Yeah, so that's that.
Yeah, cool, great. And then you have also brought with you some favorite music, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I presume there are some kind of favorites for you, but you also have like reasons for each musical choice.
Yes.
So this is going to be exciting. And apologies to the podcast listeners, I'll have to cut them to 30 seconds, but the radio listeners will hear the full the full tracks.
Yeah, the privileged.
Yeah. What's the first track and why did you choose it?
The first track is... the first track is by Matmos, duo of two, I guess they are of two men. I guess they're still together. At least they were when I was at their concert 2 years ago. And it is a track from their album, The Rose Has Teeth in the Mouth of a Beast, from 2006. And the track is entitled Track for Valerie Solanas, with some quotes from Valerie Solanas's famous or infamous manifesto entitled Scum Manifesto. A recommended reading for everybody.
Let's listen.
Being at best an utter bore in no aspect of society, being all relevant to women, there remains specific moral responsible thrill-seeking females only to overthrow the government, eliminate the money system, institute complete automation, and destroy the male sex. Destroy the male sex.
There remains to civic-minded, responsible, thrill-seeking females only to overthrow the government, eliminate the money system, institute complete automation, and destroy the male sex. Unable to relate with love, the male must...
That was Tracked for Valerie Solanas by Matmos. And Marek, since you chose this, maybe you can also tell the listeners who Valerie Solanas is. What's the significance?
Unfortunately, I can only tell you about something about who she was, because she is unfortunately no longer with us.
But somebody who has made that mark on reality is always there somehow, right?
You're so right. Yes, you're so right, as always, my dear. So she wrote a very, very famous feminist manifesto called Scam Manifesto, in which she basically advocated for, how can I put it, getting rid of male sex completely.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and she provides some very good arguments actually in a manifesto. So I recommend everybody actually to have a read.
Do you remember any arguments?
What? Oh, they're really, really, really. I mean, it would take me a while, my dear. But they are very, very feminist of the radical feminist wave of feminism, American, obviously, feminism. So, yeah, and she was also the woman, actually, who shot Andy Warhol. Mm. Not killed him, but she hurt him, yes, by shooting him. So she was incarcerated for some time for that.
Mm.
And she died, unfortunately, very poorly out of pneumonia.
Mm.
But, yeah.
It was a great track.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Cool. Super, super cool track.
I like Mademoiselle a lot, really.
I like when I hear these things that I've never heard before, and then they're actually really nice.
Yeah.
Mm.
Always there, right? Music is always there.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit more about your research. So how can music, like, play the bad guy in history?
Yeah, it can actually... Yes, do a lot of bad things.
And
my role, I mean, as a researcher here, is actually to find as many like bad or dark sides of music as I can. And this is what I have devoted my life in Norway to, I guess. So, yeah, as I said, the research is about the colonial relationship between the Netherlands and its previous colony of Suriname, a country on a northeastern side, northeastern part of South America. And I am, as I said also before, I think I am looking at a whole span of the relationship, beginning with when the colony was founded in 1651 up until the 20th century, and in 1975 the country became finally independent. At least officially, legally, from the Western cultural and economic dominion, let's say, or empire.
Mm.
So I'm like, you know, investigating the ways, as I said, in, you know, how music contributed to that colonial relationship, and it actually contributed a lot to that. So again, in broad strokes, I have divided the whole span, the whole history, into three stages. The first stage was like, you know, let's say the first century of the existence of the colony. So 17th, 18th century. So then the colonists were organizing the whole enterprise. They were founding their plantation labor camps, because Suriname was famous for its sugar mainly, but there were also other plantation labor camps like tobacco plantations or indigo plantations as well, but mainly sugar, especially at the beginning. So to do that, to like get the whole factory running, they would transport thousands of African people from West Africa to Suriname, and the Dutch would basically coerce these enslaved people to work on the plantation labor camps. And music played its role in it, or sound played in you know, a certain role in it, because the Westerners or the Dutch really wanted the enslaved people to embody this kind of subjectivity of cultivation tools of the land, mm-hmm. or just not even workers, but something like in that sense less than human, right? Something mm-hmm. worse than what they represented, what they, the colonists, represented. In order to do so, for instance, they deprived the enslaved people or prohibited the enslaved people from adhering to their sound-oriented practices. So from their singing, drumming, dancing also, which was quite prevalent among the enslaved people. So to do so, the colonists would introduce numerous law regulations that legally prohibited the enslaved people from cultivating sounds, from singing, dancing, communicating, up to some that kind of absurd prohibitions, like forbidding them from whistling, for instance, or even talking in front of a white person. Also, obviously, to prevent any kind of resistance or sharing information between the enslaved people, which was very prevalent and very rife. I mean, the enslaved people would resist the colonial power all the time. And this is probably why the colonial power responded so aggressively to that. So prohibitions, legal prohibitions, but also punishments, corporeal punishments for creating instruments, for singing, for dancing. So the enslaved people would also be very severely punished. And we know that these were very severe punishments, because there are many, many, many accounts, narratives about Suriname from that time telling us about how the enslaved people would be treated on the plantations, especially for breaching the colonial law, for instance, for adhering to their dancing or drumming. Or
the dancing was also prohibited.
Yes. Yeah, everything. Everything in terms of what we term as music, mm-hmm. Everything was forbidden. Everything was prohibited legally.
So why do you think that a colonial power would fear so much mm-hmm. the music of a people? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, music is has been seen as like harmless, mm-hmm. but did they see it as a way of communicating, or did they see it as a way of mm-hmm. showing their identity? And that was, they didn't like that they had identity, or.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that you have just said mm-hmm. was actually played part in that. So
this is during the Baroque era, right?
The European
Baroque
era, let's say early modern period. Yes. So actually, music, it was a way of representing a different type of humanity that would threaten the conditions of production on a colony, right? So the enslaved were enslaved in order to embody a mute silence cultivation tool. That was their lot imposed.
So they were supposed to be silent, or exactly. Were they also supposed to speak the language of the colonizer and make the music of the colonizer?
Mm-hmm. Not in this period. That would come later.
Just silencing.
Exactly. That would come later in the 19th century, when the colonial power knew that they couldn't silence the enslaved people, because they would still communicate, they would still cultivate their sonic traditions, they would still perform, they would still sonically perform their cultural alterity, right? That would threaten the order of the colonial let's say human in that sense. So the impositions of the Western ways of music creation and appreciation on the enslaved people would come later, towards the end of the 1700s, for instance, when we especially in the narratives left by European travelers to Suriname, you could see that something is changing in terms of how the Westerners began approaching the enslaved people, in terms of the fact that they were actually shocked that the colonial power could not silence the enslaved people, that the resistance was so strong and so prevalent that they were forced to change their colonizing tactics. And they did so also by adhering to the sonic layer. While it's probably because of the fact that music is, especially back in the day, music was, apart from religion, something that you could cultivate without any kind of tools, right? So it's not wood carving, for instance, that you need some tools, or it's not fashion that the enslaved was, by the way, deprived of. They would usually walk naked and barefoot. So everything like material, like tangible, was taken from them, while religion or a set of beliefs and music is something that you can cultivate just using your voice, right? Or tapping, or you know, clapping,
at least parts of it.
But you know, it's already, this part is already foundational.
But if you forget how to make a certain drum or something, then that is really
absolutely. Then it disappears. So obviously, some of their original practices disappeared. They were eliminated because of the colonial power and because of the prohibitions. Obviously, and in that sense, some parts of their
oral histories. Anything that can't be just the things that need human transmission, right?
Or the cultural human transmission. Yeah, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. It's beyond violent, all of this. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if there are any, do you know any examples of times when this kind of pressure or how do you say it, when the loss of freedom or huge pressure like this could actually foster some interesting movements in art, like in, I'm thinking of like marginalized people and their music, for instance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with certain pressure, although the pressure is not good, it's violent and everything, but sometimes it can, there are people who manage to make really good art in situations like that, right?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that this example...
Maybe not in this example, but in other examples.
Other examples. I mean, I guess so. I would think so. I mean, it is a cultural trait, and you can use that kind of cultural traits to do, I don't want to say that in this neoliberal capitalist way that, you know, empowers you and you can just earn a lot of money starting with a dollar because you want to create music. No, but, you know,
I'm thinking more like queer communities and...
Absolutely. I mean, it is a cultural trait and it can be used both by the dominant power and by the marginalized, oppressed groups. The struggle is always going to be there, as we know from like Marx, for instance. So you know, the struggle will always be there, but you can use that kind of tools to fight back or to change or to create a kind of a plane of resistance, right? I mean, it is a trait that allows for integration, it allows for communication, it allows for entertainment, obviously, as well. So, you know, it's a tool. So
sometimes when you work, sometimes when you work within really strict limits, then you have to find very creative solutions.
Yeah.
Like since I don't have another example right now, I'm mentioning again the example by Kristin Nordahl, who needed to, as a marginalized woman and as a composer, because there are not a lot of women, or used to be not a lot of women, she had to, she couldn't rely on sound engineers, so she started to bring with her a set of hemispherical speakers just to have full control of her sound. Mm-hmm. And hemispherical speakers are actually really cool as well. They happen to be, they happen to feel more like bodies on stage in a way, because the sound radiates in all kinds of directions. So they're not coming from this big, like godlike stereo system. They're actually on stage. So that actually is an example of somebody who had to work within certain limits. And then that created like really cool art.
And that kind of examples show that, you know, there are ways of utilizing, you know, these tools in order to intervene or interfere or influence something. We just need to,
And also some of the music that you have brought with you is created as a criticism of certain systems.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We need to criticize people. We need that, absolutely, subvert and criticize and oppose.
So the next track is called... How do you say her name? Sinead or?
Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor.
Yes.
And it's called Red Football. Let's see. Why did you choose that one?
Oh,
because it's drawing attention to the violence against women. You see?
Yes.
Trouble.
Others,
answer to trouble.
Exactly. Immediate, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, let's tell us a little bit about it, okay. And then Gusti will spin it.
Yeah, Red Football from her album Universal Mother, 1994. I love Sinead O'Connor for three things, I would say. The first one is another of her album, actually, The Lion and the Cobra, with a magnificent song entitled Troy. The other thing that I really like Sinead O'Connor is that she touches upon such issues as violence, child abuse, hypocrisy, and the evil of the Catholic Church, which I really detest. Sorry, yeah. Not sorry. And I also love her for tearing the photo of the Polish Pope, John Paul II, on stage. I really admire that woman. Yeah, let's listen to the song.
Eat you, I'm not no animal in the zoo, and I've every intention of leaping up and getting you. La 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 la.
Football by Sinead O'Connor. Thank you, Marek, for sharing this with us.
You're very welcome.
He's a very strong artist. That's great. Perfect fit for Radio Rakel. You know, we have had Pussy Riot here before.
Ooh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. Okay. Haven't we? Yeah, I think so, Gusa.
Yeah, it was before my time, but...
Yeah, so it wasn't me. I didn't have Pussy Riot here, but...
That was many years.
History.
History. Or her story.
But now you have been speaking about your research, and this is the nightmarish reality that you're living in, and yes. I'm just exaggerating it, but like it's hard labor to do research. So, but people will read it hopefully when it comes out, and great. Now we're going to move to the more artistic side of Marek Zusdorf. The writer, the performance artist. So I'm very excited about this, actually. And I asked you very kindly if you could read, an excerpt, which you will do shortly. Yes. But do you want to tell a little bit about how you use... Do you use music at all in your writing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. This is a very good question. Yes, I do, actually. I think I'm... It's going to sound like a cliche, but I'm addicted to music. I guess everybody is, and it also says a lot about who we are and how we are created and what we need in our lives. But anyway, yes, I actually do listen to music a lot while writing, even now when I am going through that exhausting period of my writing career, if I may put that in, you know, these terms. So yes, I listen to music a lot, which is like, you know, I have been listening to music since I was like very like deeply, and I became very interested in music when I was around 18 years old. So I guess that was pretty late, right? It usually is like, you know, you get something from your home, right? While in, you know, when I was young, when I was a kid, my family did not listen to music. I come from like a working class environment, Polish working class environment, and there was not a lot of music in my home. Mm-hmm. But then when I left my the village that I was raised in, I started listening to music a lot. So, and which is also another strange thing is that I have no idea why female singers and composers. Oh. I have no idea why, really, but it is like that. So it's my favorite artists or singers are Björk, of course, but also Patti Smith and Kate Bush. And Sinead O'Connor, we know that already. Yoko Ono, Grace Jones, I don't know, Tori Amos, Meredith Monk, Billie Holiday, Minnie Riperton, Nico, Delia Derbyshire, we talked about her before today's audition. Yep.
Yeah.
I guess these are the artists that I listen to
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I had another author here, Maria mm-hmm. Schulz-Van. There's another episode with her, and she also listens to music when she writes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, for me it's very difficult to concentrate if there is music because I get so carried away with the music. But it's great.
No idea how it works. I need to be surrounded with music when I write. I have no idea why. Mm. Maybe it's just, you know, helps me focus.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And can we hear an excerpt? You actually brought your book here physically, but it's only in Polish. And the cover is amazing because it looks like somebody's eating a heart. I mean, there is nobody eating, but there is a set of cutlery behind the heart, and the cutlery is actually shaped like a cross.
That is correct.
What's the title?
Yeah. The title is in Polish. It's Dziennik znalezione w błękicie. That was for the Poles here. While, I mean, I could translate it into English and it would be like a diary found in the blue, something like that. Mm. So the book is, I've actually published two books. This is my second book, which I actually really like. And it is a book about melancholy and patriarchy and what else? About God and divinity and... Yes.
And it's the first time it's being uttered at all in English.
You are right. Yeah. I translated an excerpt to.
It's great. Ah, fantastic.
Shall I start?
Yes,
maybe
yes.
Can I just say a couple of words
about
what the book is about?
But yes,
because then it would be difficult to understand. So the book is about two male lovers who used to be very in love with each other, but that stopped, and one guy still is in love with the other guy, and the other guy does not respond with the same feelings towards the first guy. So the first guy is planning and executing his plan of conducting a kind of a Christ-like passion, and he's going to eventually consume his partner. Or his ex-partner. But okay. So I'm going to just read it, right? Can I?
But the one who he is going to consume.
Yes.
The partner mm-hmm. who no longer loves him.
That is correct.
Okay.
Kind of a revenge. We love revenge people.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall I?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's one of the last scenes, actually, in a book. Okay, let's start then. I am authentically lying now in a bathtub, full of steaming water in which depths also clouds of his blood washed off from my body are dancing. When set in motion, the surface of the water slightly undulates. The light of the bathroom lamp refracts in it and flows out into the space of the room, creating bright spots on the cold walls. Now, however, I am not entirely sure if what I'm writing is correct. Because from the cracks in the walls, yes, there is something crawling out, something oozing out, something nothing other than you together with your damned self. Hey, it is you. You sneak into this bathroom, you crawl inside, you hiss softly, barely audibly, and then you twist around and you melt all over the world of the cold wall in front of me. I feel the seeds of fear inside of me, somewhere beneath my muscles, my nerves and my bones. Fear of the strange. So the lights on the walls, they are not reflections, I do not think so. The walls are bright, yes, they are hot, they are burning, it is certain. Because it is you. You crawl in and you filter in, and with the dark spots of your essence you cover the light. I can hear you, your rustles, soft purrs and whispers everywhere. You slide along the cracks of the walls, over the folds of the plaster and the protrusions of the low plastic shelves. You surround the room, you drain it with your muted, faint, balanced divinity. The hot water kindles my body anew. I can feel drops of sweat running down my face. My hair becomes softer and moist. It lies on my head, wraps my face in sticky layers. By and large, it is all an unpleasant feeling. And the steam rising from the bathtub covers the whole world. Somewhere in front of me, the view is disappearing. What windows, what bart, what the walls, what the tacky plastic utensils, they are all suddenly over-blued. It is not that I am closing my eyes, not. Above me there is a navy blue night approaching me, an inky night, a lapis lazuli night, a hyper-blue night, and at the same time an inexhaustible, impenetrable, never-lived night. This, authentically, is a strange feeling. It is all alike that moment when I once found myself in an unfamiliar book and I wondered whose hand was going to write me. I do not know anything anymore. The thickness of the steam from the bathtub seems to permeate everything. All the air, all the water, and all your blood in it. And those bitterly cold walls and such a cold ceiling, and also my body, my epidermis, skin, muscles, tendons, organs, bones, marrow. And it bites me, it reaches every corner of my body, and every thought of mine, and every impulse. There is no flesh, no flesh, no flesh around. On the other hand, there is, and yes, there has always been, and yes, there will always be the soul, the soul, the soul. Because you are still here, not corporeally, but you are authentically still here. You have arisen from the dead. You have thrown away your human skin and, in disgust, you are now looking over the rim of the bathtub at my naked human body and you hiss tauntingly, "Do not touch me." Verily I say unto you, my love, nothing else but this is what the resurrection is, an eternal, untwined and obnoxious return. I desired flesh, flesh and flesh, and even after your death, what I received was your soul, 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 in which I suffocate myself. Eternally, chronically, you will be with me, incorporeal, immaterial, divine and blue in color, of sticky and greasy consistency and sleazy in texture like God. And as I am washing off your blood of my body, I say to myself that yes, if I am a mother, then I am a mother of sorrow. I am holding in my arms your little body, sorrow, wet and blue, spongy like the fog, like me. I have a baby here, but who, tell me, sorrow, who is your father?
Oh, okay. You have to translate the whole book, Marek. You have to translate the whole book. It's, yeah, it's very strong stuff, and I love how it is. It's like both unreal and hyperreal at the same time.
This is what I really wanted to achieve with the language. Actually.
Yeah, you did, and it's like super. It's like sensory. Yeah. It's suffocatingly saturated, and then also it's like something about words are kind of essentially bodiless because they're words on paper and they have to be imagined in people's mind. Mm-hmm. But then this is so much about body, flesh, blood, so it's actually is the opposite at the same time.
Yeah, that we are actually deprived of, you know, the whole book is about, I mean, it is about the situation between the lovers, but this is just a parable. It's a parable of the system of belief that, and obviously I'm talking here about the Western Christian culture and context, that we are deprived of when we are pushed into the system of believing in something, which for me always creates this kind of a melancholic split, because we are said that we are cared for by this father-like figure of God that lives somewhere there in the sky or wherever in heaven, but actually you can never touch this person, right? So this is a father that forces you to believe in his existence, but you cannot snuggle up to him. And this melancholic split between the body and the soul, between the body and emotions, I do think it creates that kind of, as I said, melancholic feeling that will probably be never, resolved in us. I don't know.
At
least this is what the book is about. Sorry.
Ah, oh, that was amazing. It's thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Sure.
Oh, we have to talk a little bit. We should also talk a little bit about what you wrote about biophilia, by the way. We almost forgot that.
Oh yeah, you're right. About biophilia, you mean?
Yes, because I mean you wrote a whole article about Björk's biophilia. Would you like to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was a couple of years ago when I was still studying in the Netherlands at Utrecht University. I was studying gender studies, so I'm unfortunately not a musicologist. But yeah, I graduated from gender studies program in Utrecht, and then I got, I guess, conscripted by the university and their trend of new materialism and feminist new materialism and posthumanism, which kind of, to some extent, originated in Utrecht at that university, especially because of Rosie Braitotti, a professor there. So I got interested in that, and I saw some connections between these philosophies of posthumanism and new materialism and Björk's album released in 2011 entitled Biophilia, in the way she approached both sound, music, instruments, and a whole kind of a world and interconnectedness, if I may put it this way, of all human and non-human beings, because this is what ultimately the album is about, where she writes a lot about the so-called, well, today I would say the so-called nature, because I kind of, I don't want to say I grew out of these philosophies of new materialists, but I am definitely more into feminism than feminist new materialism or new materialism per se. I do think that it lacks a certain Marxist critique, like materialism.
So what was in new materialism about?
So new materialism is this strand in philosophy that is connected also to Spinoza philosophies, and Nietzsche is there, and Bergson is there, and Deleuze, who has also become like a very prominent figure in philosophy recently. And it's about
turn to nature
and turn to matter, materiality, also in this feminist way of rethinking what materiality is and it what it has always been in patriarchal mythology, let's say. So matter as this passive, inactive plane also of femininity, unfortunately, especially in the mythology of Christian philosophers or doctors. How are they called? Catholic Church doctors? Doctors of Church? Something like that. Like Saint Alphonsus, etc. So this kind of bullshit. So what they are trying is to kind of recuperate or reclaim materiality also for feminism. In feminist new materialism, it is also about displacement of anthropocentrism and, you know, the placing of the human category in the center of, or, you know, the top of the pyramid of all beings, with animals and plants being, you know, below being these creatures that are subordinate, you know, to the especially white and fully abled and male human being.
We need to get away from that.
Yeah, absolutely, and we absolutely, obviously, we need to.
So let's hear an excerpt, just because we want to talk about other things too. So Guse is gonna spin 30 seconds of the song Hollow, if you can find it. Yeah.
Let's do it.
I'm sad.
Yeah, that was part of Björk's song Hollow, which was chosen by you, Marek Zusdorf. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to talk about capitalism. I said cannibalism, but that's because you read that book to me and the excerpt to me, but it's capitalism.
I think, it's the book, but it's also the song that we are going to play, which is called Corporate Cannibal by Grace Jones.
And oh, she also, that's,
yeah, I
that's
think that
it.
Was your
that's the thing.
Slip of the tongue, or maybe not, which actually says a lot about the capitalistic hunger, insatiable hunger for new things, right?
Yeah.
That people.
And it eats people. I mean, because you earn money on the by the blood, sweat, and tears of your subordinates or whatever. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's that. But also in terms of how it conscripts, let's say, us, how it drafts us, right? As this.
Do you know what? I have to say something. Do you know what I hate so much? Whoa. It's when people say, don't you think it should be possible to work hard and then become and make money?
No.
That what they always don't say is that how about all the people who work so hard and don't make that money?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
just had to say that now because.
No, it's bullshit, but it's one of these, you know, capitalistic cliches, right? That force people to just work their asses off and then they earn a little money, but they are pushed to work even more because there is this ideology that, you know, if you kill yourself for your work, you will actually achieve something in life or earn more money or build a bigger, I have no idea what, I mean, a bigger house or a bigger bathtub or whatever you need.
Yeah.
And we actually, I mean, do we need all of these things? I mean, we probably do, but in the end, do we really need them to like live and survive? Probably not, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate the people who also work and who don't, and maybe they make the money for you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sorry that I interrupted you. It was just something that I just had to say it right now because, something I heard in the news.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
because we're now in the soon approaching the elections. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, tell me something about it. Who is winning? Are the communists winning, hopefully?
Hopefully there will be some kind of red-green coalition.
Oh, this is really nice. Okay.
Yeah, hopefully, but we don't know yet.
Okay.
But what were you about to say when I interrupted you?
I think that I was going to, I was saying, I think something about Grace Jones, right?
Grace Jones, yes, because we're going to listen to her song.
I mean, you know, we can also talk about capitalism and music, right? And how these kind of spaces for resistance that music creates are sometimes swallowed by capitalism, right? And, you know, I remember that in the 90s, Björk was actually accused of that because before she launched her musical career, she played in these anti-systemic bands like the Sugar Cubes, and they were very anti-capitalistic, at least in terms of their the lyrics and, you know, all of these punk rock vibe, etc. And then she turned into is kind of a, you know, very creative, but on the other hand very established pop music. And I remember that, I don't know whether they were, you know, her whether they were the members of the Sugar Cubes, the band that she played in, or some journalists saying that she's actually, you know, maybe being like swallowed by capitalism in terms of what her music presented earlier in that kind of a, you know, critical anti-capitalistic lyrics or, you know, music in general. And then she turned into you know, musical establishment. But what do I know? I don't know. I think it's interesting how capitalism in its sneaky way and cunning way knows how to conscript even those who rebel, who fight against, who wants to interfere. Yeah, it's a difficult thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's a whole system and it's that we also carry within ourselves, right? Capitalism is not something that is like, you know, that's separate from us, and then we can just picture it and then start fighting against that, right? It's actually fighting against ourselves. And you know, and the things that we do for to maintain and sustain this order,
yeah.
I think. I don't know. Yeah.
So and this song that we're going to listen to, you said it it is a fantastic analysis,
yes,
of capitalism.
Yes, absolutely. So the song is about Grace Jones, who I adore and I admire. I really like
icon.
Yes, exactly. And the song is entitled Corporate Cannibal from from her album Hurricane that she, I think, co-produced with Tricky. And yeah, just listen to the lyrics.
Yeah.
Which,
and then also we are off air in a couple of minutes. I just wanted to say that I'd like to, Marek, speak a little bit more with you for the podcast listeners.
Cool.
But for now, thank you so much for being part of Solveig Space and Music.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for everybody listening. Here is Grace Jones.
Corporate cannibal, digital criminal.
Oh, yeah, that was Grace.
Strong.
That was strong, and it was the icon Grace Jones. So cool.
Perfect.
So, so, so cool. So, hello, podcast listeners. This is an exclusive leg for you because we had a few more songs that Marek had brought with him, which we chatted away. So now we need to add a little bit extra time, which is nice. Yeah, so you have another song that you wanted to show us, and it's called Bamboo Banga by MIA, right?
That is correct.
So what's special about this song?
What's special about this song is that it was created by MIA, which I adore. I really, really, really like her music. I think she's an excellent rapper. And I really like especially this album. Which was called, sorry, either Kala or Kayla, I suppose it's Kala, in 2007. It was released then, and I really like the rhythms, production of this album. Fantastic arrangements, but also the lyrics, the text, okay? So
yeah.
Obviously sung by MIA about capitalism, about racism, about migration politics, about poverty, violence, and the police that we do not necessarily like, not that often. Yes, I really, really, really like that album.
So cool.
Must listen.
Yeah, and I only have the rights to quote it, so let's hear 30 awesome seconds of that song. Sounds like great party music.
Exactly.
Ah, sounds good.
Started dancing.
Yeah, Bamboo Banga, guys. Okay, thanks. And I also wanted to ask you about, you created actually an art piece once for a gallery in Barcelona.
Yes.
No? Yeah.
Yeah, it happened a couple of years ago. Yes, and it was, I was actually really, as I said before, I was really inspired back in the days by feminist new materialism. Mm. And about the philosophies of feminist new materialism, about, as I said, you know, materiality, about the turn to embodiment, but also this non-human materiality.
Which is in nature, for instance? Or
which is, for instance, in nature.
But not in inorganic things?
Yeah, this is what I wanted to say. In both biotic and abiotic things.
Oh, okay.
So it's both what we term as like organic, as you said, and inorganic. So everything. So matter is basically like a constant flow of, I mean, atoms or particles or whatever. So it's in constant movement. And this is what feminist new materialism talks about a lot, trying to reclaim this space for materiality that, according to the Western mythology, has always been placed on this like subordinate place.
Do they find the matter conscious as well?
I don't think that they find it conscious, because conscious is, I think they talk more about agency. So it has got its certain aims and goals and as I said, agency. It's difficult because, for instance, Slavoj Žižek, I called this philosophy like a fairy tale, because it tries to enliven like things, and this is what I actually also find problematic. Because when we are trying to reclaim something, we are also putting our pretty anthropocentric views on it, right? Like the very phenomenon of agency is very anthropocentric, because this is the agency how humans, or how we as humans, have.
Don't animals have agency?
You know, they probably have. I have no idea. This is what is. Yeah. This is what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that we should not fight for a better world. Sorry, but when we are trying to reclaim that space, sometimes we do something that is counterintuitive for what we advocate. So, for instance, if we're saying that we want to decenter humanocentrism by imposing humanocentric concepts, yeah, right, or phenomena on non-human beings, we are doing something very humanocentric in that sense. And
yeah,
obviously we are talking here about the Western culture and Western mythology and philosophy. So we need to be very strict about that. That it's, you know, in terms, when I say the word human, I mean it in the Western concept of that category of man, right? How it has been created in Western philosophy by numerous philosophers, etc. So that's one thing. And this is what I also disagree upon with feminist new materialism, or new materialism in general, that it is also very anti-humanocentric or anthropocentric, whilst it does not that often, as it should, problematize the very category of the human, which should be problematized. I mean, what the category is, how it has been created or utilized ideologically.
What are the alternatives? Are there other ways of construing what is a human?
We should start, I think, we especially people from the Western Europe, from the Western tradition or philosophy, we should start problematizing that, because as my research, at least so far, suggests, the Western philosophers tried to over-represent this category by imposing the Western views on humanity on the subdued and colonized people. And if you turn to philosophers like Sylvia Winter, for instance, or Walter Mignolo, they all say that the category of the human is not as we use it in Western discourse, is not what it aspires to be, because it overrepresents other experiences, other modalities of embodying the human. which is an extremely difficult and complex
argument. Do you have any concrete examples?
Yeah,
sure. Just to make it easier to understand?
Yeah. So we would have to return to my research again.
Yes, this is, please.
This is what I said. I'm, you know, I live through my research now, really. So when we return to the history of either music theory or philosophy in general, we would come across this category of man, which was a category for a human being. And this category was literally created in the 17th century by, as I said, Western philosophers and Western privileged people to embody this kind of template of who the human should be or how the human should be cultivated. And this category of man or the human was created by and for certain groups of people, for other people to follow that template and that rules, but it was created by a certain group of people. And that group of people was consisting of male, well-educated, privileged, fully abled, heterosexual, at least officially, people. So that cut, and this was actually what the category of human meant in the 17th century. So when we are talking about the Renaissance, for instance, we are not talking actually about all humans, because the Renaissance changed the conditions, the social conditions of only a handful of people. It was only for intellectuals and for the bourgeoisie that you know, that the Renaissance and the later the Enlightenment changed something. So, for instance, when we turn to the above mentioned Enlightenment, when the category of the human in the Western mythology like changed into this more from the oppressive and this hierarchical category to the more inclusive category. When you think about, for instance, the French Revolution, it was again created, that category of the human was all reformulated by certain groups of people for other groups of people to be included to that category. And again, as I said, if you return to the French Revolution, for instance, after which we know that certain groups of marginalized groups of people were included to the category of the human, etc., or to the to the cultural dominion of the Westerners, they were, you know, women, for instance, were still deprived of their rights for the next at least a century. So when we are talking about the Enlightenment, like nothing changed actually for the 50% of the population. To just begin with that blatant example, not to, you know, left alone for the colonized people, for which nothing changed after the French Revolution, for instance. Something changed after the Haitian Revolution, but it's another topic. So, you know, this category of the human has always been a very ideological and politically both utilized and created category. And this is what also makes this research that I'm doing so exciting, but also so complex, so difficult, because nowadays we use this category the category thoroughly different, while it can also you know, be led or sustained by some kind of underlying colonizing strategies and ideologies. For instance, in Poland, I mean, it was, I think, last year or 2 years ago that the president of my country said, like in an open official discussion on the record, that the queer people in Poland or in general are not people, are not humans. He said, and I quote, "This is ideology." So this is what I'm talking about. This is what I'm talking about, the category of the human and who is entitled to be a part of this community of the humans. It is always a category that is very, how do you call it, like it's fluctuating depending on current politics, ideologies, and certain social and economic goals. Yep. And it has, unfortunately, and this is what my research suggests, has always been like that.
Yeah, and also the people who have the hegemony, they would say that claim that their ideology is natural.
Exactly.
And other things are ideologies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be much easier if everybody just said, our ideology is like this,
mm-hmm.
your ideology is like
exactly.
that. Because what is natural anyway?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to finish very soon. But it's been really, really great to talk to you. We have one more example that we can play a snippet of. And it's the one that is called... Or did we finish talking about your art piece? Or did we make a huge detour? You have to tell a little bit about your art piece, and then we do the last example.
Okay, okay. So shall I return to that? Why did we do that?
I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, it was that your. I think I asked you to elaborate on feminist new materialism, perhaps.
Yes.
But then actually you did something.
Humanocentric. Oh
yeah, you did something actually.
Category of the human.
Yeah, you have done something practical and artistic that actually has. Is inspired by this theory. So just, tell me a little bit about it because I have been promising that since like half an hour now for
exactly.
the listeners.
So it is, I created, this is funny actually, sorry. I created a piece for a gallery in Barcelona, a piece that was entitled, Make Kin Not Babies, but it is actually a title of an article written by Donna Haraway.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that my piece was titled like that, but it was a couple of years ago. So Mm-hmm.
Maybe something similar?
It's still on the internet. And it is a piece that, I got inspired by her article because she says there as her title suggests, make kin and not babies.
Mm.
So she says that, you know, especially in the Western culture, with its huge emphasis on reproduction and nuclear family, etc., that maybe we should do something differently in terms of reproducing the human population, and rather turn to making kin with other beings, be them human or non-human.
Yeah.
So changing our relationship with the world that we coexist with, rather than, focusing all the time on this linear, reproductive and very humanocentric politics. So I try to put her words into practice, and I created this this art piece, let's call it this way,
mm-hmm.
where I took a doll which looked like a newborn baby, and I cut out its face and its stomach, and I placed something else in this doll. And this something else was a plant, and I do not remember how the plant was called.
Mm.
I think it's garden something, like a plant that I grew actually on my hair. So I cut my hair and I grew this plant on my hair. And this kind of, politics of care and attending to something that is not human was supposed to be embodied through this practice. While into the stomach of this doll that looked like a baby Jesus, actually, in the gallery, we just arranged it in this way. Mm-hmm. So in the belly of that baby, I put a mold that grew on a loaf of bread that I created without using yeast. So in order to create a loaf of bread, you need flour, water, and yeast.
Mm.
So I didn't want to use artificial yeast, but I actually produced them on my hands.
Wow.
So it requires a lot of time and, again, a lot of care.
Yeah.
In that, so you basically do not wash your hands for some time, in order for some bacteria to flourish on your hands, and then you mix those bacteria while kneading a dough with flowers, certain types of flowers. I do not remember which ones, but there are certain types of flowers that you need to do that, and water in order to the DAO to like grow and become a proper bread DAO. And then I just baked it, and then I'll let like mold to grow on it. And then I just put it and place it into that baby. So that was a baby, sorry, into that doll. So nobody was hurt during that process. And yes, and then we arranged that, you know, for the doll to become like a, you know, baby Jesus thing, but it's actually not human-like. It's not shaped in a, you know, it's not a human baby Jesus, but it's actually like trans, not transhuman, but like, I don't know how to say that, like more than human baby.
More than human?
More than human? The heck? I don't know. But maybe more than human? Mm. Like, you know, like a baby that is actually not human. I don't know. Too much philosophy back then in my life, really.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So now we are moving to the last song, which will be just an excerpt. So and the song is, I will let you introduce it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Let My People Go, and it's by Diamanda Galas.
That's great.
So why did you choose this song?
Yep. So it's a song, as you said, by Diamanda Galas from her live album, actually, The Plague Mass. Very interesting, very challenging in terms of like the sonic layer of this album, but it's extremely interesting. And it was released in 1991. And the whole album is a conceptual album, is devoted to people suffering from the AIDS pandemic during the 80s and early 90s. And those usually heterosexual moralists and bigots that would like moralize people that were suffering from AIDS. Yep, let us have a listen.
Yes, a little taste there of Diamanda Dallas, Let My People Go. And that's all for today. And thank you so much, Marek.
Thank you very much.
I'm so happy that you could come. Really, really happy about it. And we're trying to make this Queer Kama Sutra chess special sometime. We're looking for somebody that you can meet in a chess battle and discuss with, so... Yeah, if anybody hears it and thinks that they want to battle Marek, it's also all right to suggest yourself.
Come, people, please. We need you.
And thank you, Gusev, for running the tech part of this.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
All right, thanks. Thank you, listeners. Bye.